the Finger Lakes. A gateway, you could say. Sproing is a small community with lots of farms and vineyards around it, a lake to draw people to the area in the summer. If you needed a spy to alert you to possible trouble, it might be a good place to position one. Julian, an undercover agent for the governor? It sounded like something out of a thriller. On the other hand, what had Julian Farrow been doing since he left the police force? If he'd ever really left.
I trust Julian Farrow more than I trust Swin, Grimshaw said.
Hargreaves finished his breakfast and pushed the plate to one side. Then he nodded, as if coming to a decision.
They called him Swine at the academy.
Don't know why. It was one of those stupid things young men do, picking one or two and giving them a hard time for no reason.
Could be they saw him with a date.
Silence. You think Detective Swin acted inappropriately with Miss Devine while one of his men was also in the car?
Something happened on the way into the Sproing station. She was scared. Like, get her to the doctor's office before she collapses scared.
But she had rallied when she took the hand he offered. He'd seen her come back from whatever had upset her. She did lead you to the body.
No, the crow who was her lodger led us to the body. Vicky Devine couldn't find her way out of her own handbag.
Seeing Hargreaves' stony look, and knowing he'd dumped a potential scandal on the table, he added,
Of course. Having seen her handbag, I don't think most people would be able to find their own way out.
Hargreaves leaned forward again. His voice was quiet and rough.
You remember that backup isn't down the street. You're out there in the wild country, Wayne, on your own, no matter who answers a call for help and how fast they respond.
Business as usual, then.
They stared at each other.
What do you want while you're manning the Sproing station?
I want Officer Osgood reassigned to the station. I want him away from Swin.
You think he'll back you up? Grimshaw hesitated.
I don't know. If nothing else, he can answer phones and type up reports. Walk down Main Street in uniform and look official. Keep his eyes and ears open.
There is no safety in the dark, not even on the main street of a village, Hargreaves said quietly. Humans screwed up last summer, and we're all paying for it. What happened to Chesnick and Baker?
He sighed.
I have an old friend, a patrol captain in Lakeside, who has a line to the governor. I'll wangle it so that Osgood ends up working under your temporary command.
I'll have to find him a place to stay.
Grimshaw smiled.
The CIU team was staying at the boarding house. So am I. I can handle being in the same building as Swin. I'm not sure it would be healthy for Osgood, especially once he's reassigned.
Your call.
That was it?
No, it wasn't. Hargreaves had something on his mind.
Swin is a good investigator. He finds the evidence and prosecutors are glad to see his name on the reports. 19 cases out of 20 he is good.
Then a few mistakes get made on number 20,
Grimshaw guessed. Hargreaves shook his head.
On number 20, he's even better. All the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and somebody goes to jail, maybe even prison. But it never feels quite right.
Swin jumping on this case? It doesn't feel right. So you watch your back, you hear?
And Julian?
The waitress brought over the bill. Hargreaves put enough money on the table to cover both meals and the tip. He slid out of the booth and gave Grimshaw a long look.
The less said about Julian Farrow, the better. But I won't comment about him giving you a hand, as long as evidence isn't compromised.
Not my job to look for evidence. That's what CIU is for.
Maybe.
The word was said so quietly, Grimshaw wasn't sure he heard it. He looked at his watch and swore. He had to get moving if he was going to get back to Sproing in time to accompany Vicky Devine and her attorney when they reopened her safe deposit box. Chapter 17. Vicky. Wednesday, June 14th.
Opening the safe deposit box the next morning was better than watching a magician pull a rabbit out of a hat. You got the happy surprise of something empty being filled without the brown presents at the bottom of the hat. Everything had been returned, all the paperwork, which Ilya Sanguinati checked off the list he'd made from my record of the documents I'd put into the box. And there was even $7,000 nicely bundled. Besides me and my attorney, there were three other people crowded into the privacy room to witness the return of the paperwork. Officer Grimshaw, Detective Swin, and Valerie, who had been the head teller and was now the reluctant and temporary bank manager. When Inike called me at the crack of dawn, telling me she'd pulled out all of her money as soon as she'd heard about yesterday's naughtiness with the safe deposit box, I didn't ask how she'd found out. And I didn't need to talk to anyone else to know the bank was going to crash. The whole village was holding its breath, especially the folks who hadn't gotten to the bank yesterday and were now hoping that something would save them. Frankly, I think everyone was hoping that the bloodsuckers who sucked blood would take over the bank. The penalties for a late payment might be steep, but at least there would be a brutal kind of honesty when they sucked you dry. I placed each piece of paper in an old leather tote bag as Ilya Sanguinati checked it off. But when it came to the money, I hesitated. I had tucked 6,000 into the box. Who had made up the other 1,000? Had the bank manager taken it from his personal savings, or had he used the bank's money, which would be another bit of naughtiness? I hesitated. Then I looked at Valerie, said, "Sorry," and stuffed all the money in the tote bag.
"Don't be," Valerie replied. "I opened my box yesterday and removed the antique jewelry that belonged to my grandmother. It has more sentimental than monetary value, but I didn't want to discover it missing one day."
I hesitated a moment longer, wondering if I should put back the $1,000 that didn't actually belong to me. Then I glanced at Detective Swin and swiftly closed the box, which was empty once again. Swin wasn't old, but he looked a bit freeze-dried, and his ash-brown hair was cut short and stuck up across the top of his head, like it was iron filings being pulled by a magnet. He wore glasses with heavy black frames that dominated his face and didn't suit him at all. But the glasses didn't disguise the undiluted venom in the way he looked at me, and there was nothing I wanted more than to get away from him. Unfortunately, he was the person in the doorway and was, therefore, the person I had to squeeze past. Valerie smiled at Swin and moved her arm in an unspoken request for him to step aside so that we could all leave the privacy room, and she and I could follow procedure and return the safe deposit box to the vault. As I eased past Swin, he spoke one sentence so quietly no one else would have heard it. It was cutting and cruel and painfully familiar. Valerie and I returned the box to the vault. Maybe, if it had just been Officer Grimshaw and Ilya Sanguinati waiting for me, I could have remained polite, could have clamped down on the hurt and anger churning inside me until I got home and could break down in private. But Swin was still there, and he looked at me as if he knew what would hurt me most. And I couldn't breathe, just couldn't draw in enough air for my heart to beat and my brain to work. I bolted out of the bank, ignoring the, "Miss Devine! Miss Devine!" behind me. A few Sproingers were out on the sidewalk. They were sitting up the way they do when they're given chunks of carrots for treats, but they weren't wearing their happy faces. Neither was I. I still wanted to talk to Julian Farrow about books, but I couldn't do that until I could breathe. I marched next door and stomped into the police station. Officer Osgood, looking even younger in his official uniform, jumped to his feet. I might have jumped down his throat because he looked like a relatively safe target for the feelings building in my chest. But Officer Grimshaw and Ilya Sanguinati burst into the station, Grimshaw slamming the door in Swin's face and pausing to turn the simple lock. And Mount Victoria erupted.
"I know I'm not pretty,"
And I know I'm not smart, but I don't deserve to be treated like trash. To be pushed and pushed until I'm too tired and worn down and I agree to something that I don't believe.
I pointed at the door, aiming my finger between Grimshaw's and Ilya's shoulders.
Why is Detective Swin here? I didn't know the man who died. I didn't have an appointment to see him or talk to him. And I didn't kill him. So why is Swin pushing and pushing, saying it's my fault, and I'd better come clean about what I did, and how selling the jumble will be the only way to pay for any kind of attorney who might be able to get me a reduced sentence? Why is he saying that?
That's the trouble with hiding in your safe place and hearing but not hearing a verbal hammering. You do hear the words, and with the right trigger, all your feelings come out as word vomit or lava. A hot projectile that can't be controlled at all.
And why would that bank manager help someone take the things out of my safe deposit box?
I'll tell you why. Because no one thought I would make a fuss. And even if I did, who would listen to me? And I was just expected to swallow it. Well, I'm not gonna swallow it. I was given the jumble as the main part of the divorce settlement because everyone thought it wasn't worth much of anything, but the assessed value looked good on paper. See how generous he was to give her some of the land that had been in his family for generations? But now, someone thinks it is worth something and wants to take it away after I worked so hard to build a new home and...
I was done. Drained. Didn't even have a piddle of lava left to finish the sentence. Three men stared at me. Osgood looked ready to crash through the window and run. Grimshaw looked grim. And my vampire attorney? I couldn't begin to figure out what he was thinking about my hysterics. I took a couple of deep breaths to steady myself.
I still have some business with Julian Farrow that I would like to take care of before I go home.
I'll walk you over,
Officer Grimshaw said.
Could Officer Osgood do that?
Ilya asked.
I can hold the bag with Miss Devine's valuables while she runs her errand.
Grimshaw hesitated. Then looked at Osgood.
Officer?
Osgood swallowed hard. He wasn't dill pickle green like the bank manager had been yesterday, but his brown skin did have a green tinge.
Yes, sir.
I wondered whom he feared more, me or Swin, but I didn't ask. Didn't make some lame joke designed to hurt feelings. I didn't want to be caught alone by Swin either. And I was grateful for any escort, even if I should have been adult enough not to need one. It turned out Officer Osgood and I both had an escort. The Sproingers formed two lines, a hopping honor guard for us to walk between as we crossed the street to let us read. Julian Farrow opened the screen door as we approached. The Sproingers sproinged into the shop, then clustered around the door. I hurried over to the island in the center of the front room.
I handed out carrots this morning,
Julian told the Sproingers. They all gave him the happy face, but none of them crowded him as if they expected food. Julian nodded to Officer Osgood, who took a position between me and the Sproingers, as if he couldn't decide what was more dangerous. I guess he hadn't seen them before. Otherwise, he would have known he would be safe unless he wore orange socks. Apparently orange is the color of carrots and pumpkins, another Sproinger favorite food, and their little brains couldn't quite understand that not everything that was orange was tasty or food. Or else they just liked biting things that were orange, and woe to the ankle under the orange sock.
You look a bit flushed, Vicky,
Julian said.
Would you like some water?
Yes, thanks. I felt a little sick and desperately needed to regain control.
Officer.
Thank you,
Osgood said. While we waited for Julian, I eyed the stacks of books on the island, books that had been returned for used book credit, but hadn't been processed yet to be put on the shelves. Julian returned with a large wooden tray that held three glasses of water and a small dog bowl of water. He set the bowl near the door. I'm not sure any of the Sproingers drank any of the water. But they seemed to have a good time giving each other a bit of a splash before grooming.
Despite the splashing, at least half of them watched whatever was going on outside, standing on each other in order to look out the screen door. Maybe their brains weren't so little. And maybe those ankle-biting incidents weren't mistakes caused by orange socks. At least, not all of them.
Are you browsing? Or are you looking for specific titles?
Julian asked. Recalled to my task, I leaned forward. I have some friends who really liked the cop and crime shows on TV last night, and probably would really enjoy reading thrillers, but I don't think they have the reading skills for the books I already have at the Jumble. I didn't want to buy something inappropriate that could sour their anticipated pleasure in visiting the story place, or sour their opinion of me.
Would those friends be your new employees?
Julian had a knack for figuring things out. Oddly enough, he was rubbish at playing Murder, a board game where you tried to figure out who was murdered and how they died. Have you met Conan and Cougar?
Yes.
I went up on my tiptoes so I could lean a little farther before whispering. I don't want to insult them by offering kiddie books. They are adults after all, but I don't want them frustrated either. And I didn't want them to blame me for being frustrated. Julian stared at the counter. Then he looked at me.
Wait here.
Officer Osgood relaxed enough to look at the bookshelves closest to him, and I watched the Sproingers. The ones who noticed me watching made the happy face. The rest of them blocked the doorway and stared at something in the street. Julian returned with a large stack of books. He set them on the counter, then held one up, so that I could read the title and see the cover. The Wolf Team? He nodded.
They're stories about a group of adolescents with special skills who help beings in trouble.
Did they have a phone number?
I could be a being who needed help. They're written for Terra Ingenie youngsters.
Julian opened the book to a random page and held it out.
Take a look.
I didn't know the characters or their mission, because Julian had opened the book a few chapters into the story. But I started reading midway down the page, just to get a feel for the language, and decide if I should add a couple of the books to my guest library.
Oh. Ew.
Goodness! Could Terra Ingenie wolves really do that? A hand came down on the book, and I squeaked, and jumped back as far as my arms allowed without giving up the book and losing my place. After all, I did have priorities. My heart pounded. My lungs strained against muscles that were corset tight. I heard chattering behind me, followed by the thumps of several things hitting the floor. I stared at Julian and realized he looked as startled by my reaction as I felt. And then there was the weird way my slacks were twitching at knee height. Maybe I should reorder my priorities until we sorted out the whole thing about the dead man. Julian lifted his hand off the book and offered a wary smile.
Maybe you'd like to take the book with you and start reading from the beginning?
Why would Julian be wary of me? I turned my head just enough to see the handful of books at Officer Osgood's feet. Probably the thumps I'd heard when I squeaked an alarm. Something patted my knee. I looked down at the Sproinger standing next to me. The Sproinger looked up at me and patted my knee again. A silent query. I'm fine, I said. Really, I'm fine. I smiled at the critter. The Sproinger made the happy face and returned to his buddies. They all looked at me and made the happy face before resuming sentry duty. I went back to staring at Julian. He understood what I said. Actually, I didn't know if that particular Sproinger had a vigorous appendage. That wasn't important. The fact that Sproingers understood human speech was important. Gods, they hopped around the village every morning, cadging treats from most of the businesses or browsing in people's yards.
Uh-huh.
Julian sounded like it wasn't the least bit important, and I took the hint. Sproingers probably knew every secret in the village, and if the people realized the critters not only heard but understood those secrets, there would be a lot fewer people handing out carrots. But that sidestepped the real question. If the Sproingers understood everything, or almost everything, that was being said around them, whom did they tell? And how would they interpret the past few minutes and my squeak of alarm? And who might get blamed for alarming me? I suddenly understood why Julian felt wary.
I zoned out. You got caught up in the story. That's a good sign. Do you want the series?
He held up a hand, as if I had already protested that I couldn't afford them.
The human females in the early books are wimps. I fully acknowledge the lack of understanding about your gender, so don't come back and snarl at me about it.
However, I'd heard that some of the writers of the Wolf Team books spent a few weeks in Lakeside last winter while planning some new stories, and the human female pack attached to the courtyard helped them adjust their thinking, to say nothing of their attitude. The human girls in the latest story still can't take on the bad guys by themselves. It is a Wolf Team story after all, but they're more kick-ass. Or as kick-ass as human females with no special powers beyond intelligence and good hearts can be.
I can't burn through my whole book budget.
I eyed the books, willing to be persuaded because, darn it, I wanted to find out what happened.
I told you before I would open a line of credit for you.
I loved books. And given a line of credit, I could imagine having to sell my car to feed my book addiction and pay off my bookstore debt.
$200 limit, Julian said.
I needed some kind of solace, and it was either books or ice cream. If I bought the books, I'd have more than an evening's pleasure, and I could justify it because other beings would read them too. But I'd ask Aggie if she liked ice cream, just for future reference. I left the store with a stuffed lettuce reed carry bag, and Officer Osgood left with 3 of the 5 books he'd originally selected. We scanned the street, noticed Officer Grimshaw's cruiser was gone, and scurried back to the police station, relieved that there was no sign of Detectives Swin and Reynolds. Of course, that didn't mean anything. They could be waiting for me inside the station. The bad guys in stories always managed to slither out of hiding places just before the hapless protagonist thought she had reached safety. But it was my yummy vampire attorney who opened the station door and stepped aside. As we walked in, I wondered, briefly, if I should switch to reading romances again. At least those stories wouldn't keep me up at night.
Chapter 18 Grimshaw. Wednesday, June 14th. Grimshaw studied Swin's face as the man stepped out between 2 parked cars, and then realized how much attention he would draw to himself if he tried to get through the line of Sproingers in order to reach Vicky Devine.
Fury. I assume you wanted me to stay in order to discuss something in particular, Grimshaw said, glancing at Ilya Sanguinati, who was also watching Detective Swin.
How is your hearing, Officer Grimshaw?
The Sanguinati asked. The words were polite, courteous even, but Grimshaw heard the frosty anger underneath. He understood the anger, felt it himself.
My hearing is just fine, he replied.
He'd seen the stunned hurt on Vicky Devine's face when she walked past Swin to leave the safe deposit privacy room. And having heard the words, he understood why she'd erupted once she reached the police station.
You humans have a saying about sticks and stones breaking bones, but words not hurting.
A dumbass piece of wisdom that has been proven wrong too many times to count. Words can cause as much damage as a fist. They can leave deep scars that never fully heal. And they can kill.
Was that what had happened at the jumble? Despite insisting otherwise, had Vicky Devine met Franklin Cartwright on the farm track? Had he told her why he was there? Or had he made an excuse, surveying the property line or something like that, and didn't reveal he was there to evict her? Did he know enough about her to realize she could, and probably would, get lost on her own land? Had he counted on her wandering around while he hurried to the jumble's main house to search for whatever he'd gone there to find? Or had Cartwright said something,
like Swin had at the bank, thinking he had pushed the right button to make her cave into his demands, and instead had triggered a more physical and violent reaction. The biggest problem with that theory was that nothing human could have killed Franklin Cartwright. Ilya Sanguinati turned away from the window to look at him.
"You really do look like a fire plug with feet.
Would you say that to a stranger, or a female you had met recently?"
"I wouldn't say it at all, even if it were true," Grimshaw snapped.
Vicky Devine was short and plump, and shaped more like a box than an hourglass. But only a crass idiot would say something that mean to a woman he'd met in passing. He stiffened when he realized what the vampire was driving at.
"No, I wouldn't say it to a stranger or an acquaintance. Saying that to a woman, that's personal.
Sexual. Intimate. Something an abusive lover might say, in jest of course, to undermine a woman's self-confidence." Ilya Sanguinati nodded.
"Yes, it's personal. And Detective Swin's phrasing, to me, sounded like he was agreeing with something someone else had said."
Crap. There were a couple of questions he needed to ask Captain Hargreaves, but not here. He didn't want to bring anyone to the Sanguinati's attention.
"There are some things I need to do for the investigation," he said. "You're welcome to wait here until Miss Devine and Officer Osgood return. It shouldn't be much longer."
He couldn't be certain of that. And, if it had been anyone else, he might have insisted on locking up. But everyone on the police force knew the Sanguinati's other form was smoke, and they could flow through a keyhole if they wanted to enter a building. Not to mention that Silence Lodge owned the building, and Ilya most likely had keys to the station. He would show a little trust, in the hope of having it reciprocated, especially if he discovered anything that was going to enrage the Terra Indigene.
"Thank you. I will wait."
Grimshaw scanned the street before getting into his vehicle. Swin and Reynolds were nowhere in sight. Maybe they had gone back to the boarding house. He knew they weren't in the bookstore. He was pretty sure that would have caused a Sproinger riot. Chesnick's body had been taken to Bristol for the autopsy, but the other two bodies might still be at the funeral home, and hopefully the mortician and Dr. Wallace could supply a few answers. Sheridan Ames, the public face of Ames Funeral Home, was a stringy woman in her late 40s. Her hard features were accented by a severe black pantsuit. The only soft thing about her was her luxuriously thick hair, which was a rich brown with red highlights. Yesterday, she had been professionally pleasant when he'd stopped in to confirm that the two bodies had arrived at the funeral home. Today, she was cold.
"If you've come to look at the bodies again, they've been taken to Bristol for autopsy to determine cause of death," she said.
Grimshaw studied her. Not just cold. She was seriously pissed off at police in general. Since that hadn't been her attitude yesterday, he took a guess at the reason she had changed.
"Detective Swin was already here.
I don't appreciate being accused of tampering with evidence. I don't appreciate being accused of taking evidence. Dr. Wallace did go through the pockets of those two men. Did confirm their ID. I was with him the whole time. And I made a list of every single item as it was removed and identified. And despite what Detective Swin wants to put on the report, nothing human killed those three men."
"Three?"
Calhoun had died of the head and neck injuries before the ambulance had reached the hospital in Bristol, but there was no reason Sheridan Ames would have known that.
"The first dead man, the one Vicky Devine found at the jumble."
"Any thoughts about what did kill them?"
he asked.
"You should talk to Dr. Wallace."
"I will, but I'd like your opinion too."
She had been standing behind her desk, making it clear that she didn't want to give him time or answers. Now she sat down and invited him to do the same.
"Let's start with Detective Chesnick,"
Grimshaw said.
"The one who died of blood loss?"
He nodded.
"His legs were ripped up, clawed. Could a bear or a big cat have done that?"
He remembered seeing a picture of a grizzly bear's paw next to a human head. The paw was bigger.
Gods, Sheridan said. It should have occurred to me, but I didn't think about the significance of big forms of Terra Indigene hunting in the jumble. Has anyone warned Vicky Devine?
The big shifters aren't hunting exactly. Her employees now include one of the bear guard and one of the panther guard.
And the gods only knew what lived in the wooded land around the northern end of the lake. She sat back. Grimshaw said nothing, just gave her time to think it through. Finally, she shook her head.
Whatever clawed that man's legs was bigger than a bear or a panther. A lot bigger, she said. And I'm pretty sure it wasn't the same thing that killed the other two men. At least, it didn't take the same form. Clawed hand versus clawed paw.
Big hands, he said softly. Both Franklin Cartwright and Detective Baker had been killed by something strong enough to pick up grown men and twist them.
Yes.
Sheridan sat forward and folded her hands on her desk. Concerning Detective Baker, Detective Swin was particularly angry about a missing tie clip when he came by yesterday. He insisted that Baker had been wearing one that morning and wanted me to admit that Dr. Wallace or I had taken it. I gathered he went back to the boarding house and searched Baker's room for the missing item and didn't find it, because he was back here this morning, demanding to look at the items that had been with the bodies. Of course, Dr. Wallace had made the arrangements and the bodies had been driven to Bristol at first light, along with everything that had been found with them. I asked him for a description of the tie clip. I know Inike Xavier asked as well since he was so obsessed with finding it. But he wouldn't tell us what it looked like beyond being a tie clip.
What about Chisnick? Did he have a tie clip?
He did. Swin wasn't interested in that one.
Grimshaw thanked her and left the funeral home. But after returning to his car, he sat in the parking lot, thinking. All the men on Swin's team had worn ties and had used tie clips. What was significant about Baker's? A man wouldn't wear something expensive on the job. Not when he was out investigating. There was always the possibility of losing it somewhere. But maybe it was expensive, and Swin wanted to return it to Baker's family. Or maybe it had some other significance. Was that why Swin didn't want to describe it? Because he didn't want a description of a particular tie clip going into an official report? If it had been logged in with the other personal effects, would it have disappeared after Swin visited the funeral home? And would Swin, despite being warned off, return to the jumble to search for the missing item? Grimshaw started the cruiser and returned to the station. The black luxury sedan was gone from its parking spot. So were Ilya Sanguinati and Vicky Devine. Officer Osgood looked desperate to find something official to do.
Problem?
Grimshaw asked. Detective Swin is upset that I've been transferred to this station and am under your command.
You have any idea why Swin pulled you into this assignment in the first place?
No, sir. Grimshaw sighed.
Well, I'll talk to a couple of people and see if I can find you a place to stay while you're working here.
I'm staying at the boarding house. Osgood's brown eyes looked huge. Miss Xavier threw Detective Swin and Reynolds out of her place. Somebody told them she was pitching their stuff onto the front lawn, and when they got to the boarding house, she told them if they so much as set a toe inside her house again, she would report them.
To whom? Grimshaw wondered. Did something happen to upset her?
Osgood winced. They fed their prunes to the dog this morning. I guess he got sick enough that the vet from Crystalton came to the house. So Swin would have to find accommodations at a nearby town or withdraw from the investigation. Swin wasn't going to withdraw. He shouldn't have been there in the first place, so he'd be back for the same reason he got involved. Osgood held out a pink message slip. Miss Xavier said to tell you that she's boxing up the other detective's belongings, and if you don't pick them up by tomorrow morning, she'll donate everything to the volunteer fire department to sell.
Did you tell her she couldn't do that?
I've heard Miss Xavier has a smoking gun tattoo on one thigh as a kind of warning.
Crap.
Well, there was one good thing. Osgood seemed to be a gossip magnet, which was bound to be helpful as long as he just listened to gossip and didn't spread any information.
I have an assignment for you, Grimshaw said.
Find out if any place around here is having a block sale, yard sale, moving sale, swap and shop. I need trinkets. Shiny things that a teenage girl, or a crow, would be drawn to. I need them as soon as you can get them. He pulled out his wallet and handed Osgood $50.
That's your budget. Nothing has to be expensive. It just has to shine.
Yes, sir. One beat of silence.
Why?
Grimshaw sighed.
Because I need to bribe someone to return a piece of evidence.
Chapter 19. Ilya. Wednesday, June 14th. As soon as he delivered Victoria Devine back to the jumble, Ilya asked Boris, his driver, to return to Sproing. He could have reached his quarry faster if he'd shifted to his smoke form and traveled cross-country, but the days of the Sanguinati being subtle about their control of the village were over.
I won't be long, he said, when Boris pulled into a parking space in front of the bookstore.
Going inside, let us read. Ilya walked up to the island counter, his dark eyes locked on Julian Farrow's gray ones. He set a piece of paper on the counter.
I'd like any of these books that you have in stock.
New copies are preferable, but I'll take used copies.
Julian looked at the titles, froze for a moment, then met Ilya's eyes.
You haven't lived up to your side of the bargain, Mr. Farrow, Ilya said softly.
From what I can tell, Vicky's anxiety has its roots in damaged self-confidence and intimacy issues.
Julian almost growled the words.
Those issues are personal, but she's dealing with them and they haven't interfered with the restoration of the jumble or posed any threat to this village. Therefore, they were none of your business.
Now they are.
At least Farrow wasn't pretending he didn't understand the significance of Ilya wanting these particular books about human anxiety attacks and different forms of abuse.
You should have informed me that Victoria Devine had a weakness.
It's not a weakness, Farrow snapped.
A wound, then. A vulnerability that leaves her open to attack.
Show me a human living on this continent who isn't wounded in some way.
Defensive. Cornered. A human dangerous enough not to be taken lightly. But that was the reason the Sanguinati had made a bargain with Julian Farrow in the first place. As he noted how white the scar on Farrow's cheek looked, on a face made harsh by anger, it occurred to Ilya that Julian hadn't pointed out that the other informant in the village also had failed to mention these anxiety attacks, hadn't tried to lessen his own failing. And Ilya suddenly understood and appreciated that the anger and defensiveness were protective. Not Victoria's mate. Not yet. Maybe never. But the desire to protect was there nonetheless. Understanding that, he used the tone of voice that he used when discussing a problem with one of his own kind. With an equal.
Detective Swin used words to open that wound yesterday when he and his man drove Victoria to the village, Ilya said. And this morning at the bank, what he said to her was not only wounding, but very personal.
Farrow stared at Ilya, then looked past him, as if he was piecing together something that wasn't visible to anyone else.
Then he knows someone who knew her before she came to Sproing.
Agreed.
Farrow continued to look toward the street.
The first body stirred up people and had them talking, worrying that the trouble might come into Sproing itself. But it didn't change the core feel of the village. Grimshaw being assigned here. A blanket feeling of relief. And budding hope in the villagers that they could take up the business of living without being afraid all the time.
And the arrival of Swin and his men?
Ilya asked. All the color drained out of Pharaoh's face as he whispered,
The stench of overripe garbage spreading beyond the alley into the streets. Into the shops. Into the homes.
Interesting. Julian Farrow always said that he felt places, not people. But this was the first time the Intuit had revealed anything that descriptive about what he sensed. It sounded more like a memory than an observation about the here and now.
Whatever really brought Swin here will sour this village, he said.
Farrow nodded.
The restoration of the jumble is the key to Sproing's survival.
Farrow nodded again.
Then perhaps we can work together to ensure that Victoria retains control over the human part of the Terra Indigene settlement.
Farrow gave him a tight smile.
We can do that. But it can be a fine line between helping someone and giving that person the impression that you don't think she's capable of helping herself.
Ilya repressed a sigh. That fine line in a wounded female like Victoria was probably smudged, and all he could hope for was not to stumble too far over that line and make matters worse.
Do you still want these books?
Farrow asked.
Yes.
As Farrow turned away, Ilya added, I didn't feed on her, in case you wondered. Farrow didn't reply, but Ilya had the impression that the human male was relieved.
Chapter 20. Vicky.
Wednesday, June 14th.
I thought some rude things about Julian Farrow when I unpacked the bag of books and discovered he'd sold me the first 5 Wolf Team books instead of the whole set, filling the bottom of the bag with books by someone named Alan Wolfgard, as well as other authors I hadn't heard of. Then I saw the boy's response to the Wolf Team books, and could, grudgingly, appreciate Julian's strategy. Conan and Cougar weren't swift readers, or accurate spellers, if the sign on the chain across my access road was anything to go by. So 5 books would be plenty for the 4 readers currently using my library. And when they had finished with those books, there would be more that could be purchased, either by me or by them. If I was very brave, or incredibly stupid, and took them into Sproing to visit Let Us Read and purchase books for themselves. For a community that maintained that the others were out there, Conan and Cougar would be an eye-opener, and probably fill the doctor's office with a slew of people experiencing heart palpitations or dizzy spells, especially if someone forgot about looking human and slapped a paw on a counter to lay claim to something of interest. Then again, if people signing up for the trail rides that Inike had proposed weren't interested in seeing the Terra Indigene, they wouldn't be getting on horses and riding around in the other's backyard, so to speak. But I could appreciate that there was a difference between seeing one of the bear guard in the woods and having one sit on the stool next to yours at the diner. There would always be the possibility that you would look tastier than the food on his plate. I'd been more focused on Conan's and Cougar's reactions to the books because of the whole tooth and claw thing they had going for them. But eventually I realized Aggie was spending a lot of time looking at the covers and not saying anything. Nothing of interest? I asked. She traced the title on one of the books with a finger.
If there was a reader at the jumble, more of the Terra Indigene could enjoy the stories. Every Terra Indigene settlement has a reader, sometimes more than one.
Aggie looked at me. Conan and Cougar looked at me. You want me to be the designated reader? I could hear the capital R when Aggie said the word. They all smiled at me. Conan and Cougar hadn't seen enough smiling humans to get all the teeth sorted out. The result was unsettling. It also made me wonder how they enunciated as well as they did. I guess we could start with the first Wolf Team book, I said. Maybe I could read for an hour before dinner tonight. It had been a while since I'd done any reading aloud, but I thought I could do a decent job reading to the 3 of them. Aggie bounced up and down and clapped her hands. As she dashed out of the room, she said,
I'll tell my kin. They'll pass the word.
Kin? Word? Conan took the 2nd Wolf Team book, and Cougar took the 3rd, before wandering off and leaving me to sort through the rest of the books Julian had tucked into the bag. I remembered seeing some of the titles in the stacks of books he'd had on the island counter.
I didn't recognize the authors or the publishers. Of course, I didn't know Alan Wolfgard's work either. But the name offered a clue about what he was. Using half a piece of heavyweight writing paper, I made a tent sign, put it on one shelf in the library, and shelved the new books I'd purchased that day. As I worked, I let my thoughts wander through the events of the past 48 hours. A lot had happened since I called the Bristol police station to report a dead body. Detective Swin and Reynolds were forbidden to return to the jumble, and Ilya Sanguinati had stressed on the ride home that if Swin or anyone working for him contacted me, I was to hang up immediately and call him. Officers Grimshaw and Osgood were exempt from that gag order, but no one else. It seemed excessive to insist on no contact at all, since I wouldn't mind answering a question or two if it helped solve the puzzle of why the first man had ended up dead. But Ilya seemed to be holding back a fair amount of anger, and I didn't want it spilling over on me, so I agreed to do what he asked. Then it struck me. He had heard what Swin had said. I doubt he understood why it had hurt so much, or why I'd gotten so churned up instead of calling Swin an asshat and moving on. But he'd witnessed the eruption of Mount Victoria and had decided to shut down the problem by denying Swin any access to me without him being present. So, yay, Team Vicky. The shelf with the new books looked so nice. I made a few more tent signs and rearranged the books I'd previously acquired. I spent a happy hour putting the books into categories so that other residents and potential guests of the jumble could find specific kinds of books. I slipped the last book into place when Aggie's comment about having a reader truly sank in. Every Terra Indigene settlement has a reader. I wasn't really the proprietor of a human business. Like Honoria Dane, I was the token human who provided a valuable service by bridging the cultural gap between the others and the residents of Sproing. Given that the survival of humans on the continent of Thasia depended on the others feeling some tolerance toward us, bridging the cultural gap should be a good thing. Which made me wonder if the attempt to force me out was part of a plan to have a particular person replace me in order to influence the Terra Indigene who lived around Lake Silence, or if it was part of a plan to break any chance of peace between our species. When in doubt, call your attorney. I didn't think I'd sounded urgent, but I'd barely had time to pick up my basket of gardening tools and start weeding the flower beds that bordered the screen porch when Ilya Sanguinati walked up behind me, startling me enough that I squeaked and would have fallen on my butt if he hadn't grabbed one of my arms and hauled me to my feet. I didn't hear the car. I had to stop squeaking and develop the full-bodied scream that actors in scary movies manage to achieve. Then again, they weren't really scared breathless, which I'm sure helped with scream volume.
I came across the lake, Ilya said.
You have a boat? I couldn't imagine him rowing a boat or paddling a canoe, so maybe it was a little sailboat? He laughed.
The Sanguinati smoke form can travel over water as easily as land, and the direct route across the lake was faster than using the car. He waited a beat. You had a question? Every Terra Indigene settlement has a reader.
That is a statement, not a question.
Aggie and the boys are excited about me being the reader here, but I'd like to know exactly what that means.
Because of the sacrifice usually required to achieve it, being the reader is a position of respect in a settlement.
Sacrifice? What kind of sacrifice?
Would you like to work while we talk?
He asked.
I don't want to disrupt your schedule of chores.
I noticed he didn't offer to help. Then again, when the Sanguinati turned into smoke, their clothes also turned into smoke, which just added to their mystique. I had heard that the whole turning into smoke thing was the reason the Sanguinati always dressed in black or shades of gray. That might be something someone made up, or it could be cultural, like simple life men wearing dark trousers, white shirts, and suspenders. But seeing Ilya crouch beside me as I weeded the flower bed, I really wanted to ask if it was as hard to get grass stains out of Sanguinati clothing as it was regular old human clothes.
Every form of Terra Indigene has its own teaching stories. The lessons one generation passes on to the next, Ilya said. And there are stories that are told as entertainment, that appeal to many different forms. It's only in the past few decades that some of our stories have been written down and put into books that many can enjoy.
Like the Wolf Team stories and the books by Alan Wolfgard?
He smiled. Exactly. But reading printed words is a human skill, and to most forms of Terra Indigene, acquiring human skills is considered a necessary contamination. A sacrifice a small percentage of us make in order to keep watch over the two-legged predators who are also prey.
Well, hearing that sure made me feel special. It also made me realize how the jumble was different from other Terra Indigene settlements. The readers aren't usually human, are they? They're Terra Indigene who have learned to read well in order to share the stories with the rest of the residents.
Yes. Here, with you, the reading hour can be a point of interaction as well as entertainment. And a lot of responsibility.
Every day?
Oh, no. Perhaps one evening a week. And not on your cop and crime TV night. You could read a chapter from a book, like The Wolf Team. On another evening, a folk tale, or one of your human teaching stories. On the third evening, you could read an article or two from a magazine like Nature. Something nonfiction.
I stopped weeding and looked at him. I would think he would know more about the natural world than the humans writing about it.
But knowing how humans view the world is valuable, Ilya countered.
3 evenings a week didn't sound too demanding, and most human social life finished up soon after sundown, since everyone who didn't want to be eaten stayed home after dark. So I would still have plenty of time for my own reading and personal chores.
Julian Farrell might have books of human folk tales or short stories that the jumble's residents would find appealing, and he could stand in as a second reader, Ilya said casually.
Too casually? No. I could not have heard what I thought I'd heard.
Is there anything else? Ilya asked.
No. I just wanted to be clear about the duties of the reader before tonight's story time.
Then I'll wish you a good evening, Victoria.
I watched him walk away, kind of hoping I would see him do the smoke thing. But he still looked human when he walked down the grassy slope that led to the beach, and my thoughts circled back to what he'd said. I sat back on my heels and stared at the flower bed. If Inike had suggested that Julian could help me be the designated reader, I would have said she was playing matchmaker. But Ilya Sanguinati? Nah. Conan fetched a chair from the kitchen, and Cougar fetched a floor lamp from the social room, along with a small table where I could set a glass of water. After they conferred with Aggie about potential locations for story time, the three of them had decided that I would stay in the screened porch so that biting insects wouldn't distract me from reading the story. And by using an extension cord to plug in the lamp, I could be positioned as close to the porch door as possible so that my voice would carry across at least part of the back lawn. By the time I opened the kitchen door, ready for my first attempt at being the jumble's reader, I'd convinced myself that just because Aggie had spread the word, that didn't mean anyone would show up. I'd had no idea that many crows lived in the jumble. I'd had no idea that many crows could fit on my porch. I didn't know what to say about the large hawk that was perched on the back of the chair I was supposed to use. I was pretty sure asking him, her, to move was not a good idea. I was pretty sure having that beak a few inches above my head wasn't going to help my reading skills. I didn't know this story. What if there was a hawk who worked with the villains instead of the good guys? And if this was the same hawk who had gouged the paint on the roof of Detective Swin's car, I didn't want to think about what those talons could do to me. Breathe, Vicky, breathe, and believe that no harm comes to the reader. Aggie, in human form, sat on the porch floor beside my chair. Conan and Cougar also sat on the porch floor.
We're almost ready, Aggie said. The Owl Guard.
Oh, there they are.
I watched two owls glide in from somewhere and perch on a branch of the nearest tree. And I felt a gentle tug on my hair, as if someone was trying to figure out how to comb it. But the only being, oh gods, the hawk was trying to preen my hair. I didn't want to imagine what would happen if one of his feet got tangled up in it, so I leaned forward a little, grabbed the book, and said with manic brightness, "Why don't we start?" I couldn't see what was out there just beyond the porch. I caught a glimpse of tufted ears before something settled on the porch steps. "Breathe, Vicky, and make a note to schedule anxiety attacks after reading time. Today we'll start the first book about the wolf team," I said, raising my voice, although I wasn't sure that was necessary, considering my listeners. "It's called Sharp Justice." I took a sip of water, then set the glass on the table. Chapter 21. Grimshaw. Thursday, June 15th. Grimshaw locked the door of his room and headed downstairs for breakfast. He'd been in charge of the Sproing police station for 2 full days and had 3 dead bodies. 4 if he counted Franklin Cartwright, who was the reason he'd ended up in Sproing in the first place. Last summer, most of the Northeast region hadn't received the brunt of the Terra Indigene's rage against humans, but he'd seen plenty of bad things during the Great Predation, enough that he considered a full night of dreamless sleep a blessing. Since Detectives Chesnick and Baker had wandered through his dreams last night, he really hoped today would be a corpse-free day. He paused at the door to the dining room when he noticed Paige Xavier sitting next to David Osgood, a shoebox between them on the table.
"Come on," Paige coaxed. "You can tell me. What is it for?"
"I told you," Osgood replied, sounded cornered. "It's for a police investigation." Paige gave the baby cop a smile that was 2 parts siren and 1 part terrifying. In other words, female with a capital F.
"What are you investigating? The loot you can buy at block sales and estate sales?"
She tapped the shoebox.
"Don't forget who showed you the yard sale and helped you pick out most of this stuff."
Grimshaw tipped his head back and looked at the ceiling, but the ceiling chose not to divulge any answers or even offer a paint flake or 2 of wisdom. Maxwell, the border collie, dashed over to Grimshaw and gave him a sniff to confirm that his current flock of people sheep was all accounted for. The movement drew Osgood's and Paige's attention. Grimshaw entered the room and took a seat.
"Good morning."
"Coffee?"
Paige asked, jumping up to pour him a cup.
"Thanks."
He studied Osgood, who was squirming as if his breakfast prunes were working enthusiastically.
"You found something?"
"I took David to a place in Crystalton called the Yard Sale," Paige replied as she filled Grimshaw's cup. "Most block sales and yard sales are done on the weekends, but the yard sale is a shop that buys from estate sales and such and is open during the week. I could have been more help in selecting things if I had known the reason behind this shopping spree."
"You helped?"
He knew that, having just heard her say it, and there was no reason why she couldn't have helped Osgood select the items. She wasn't handling evidence or anything like that. But he was interested in why she had helped.
"I did."
Paige set the coffee pot on a hot pad.
"Since the 2 of you are our only guests at the moment, Inike is doing omelets for breakfast instead of putting out a buffet. Would you like anything in particular in your omelet?"
"Nothing exotic," Grimshaw replied. "Otherwise, whatever Miss Xavier has available."
When Paige didn't show any sign of heading to the kitchen, he looked at Osgood and held out his hand for the box.
"We need something to trade in order to recover a piece of evidence."
"Citizens are supposed to surrender evidence,"
Paige pointed out.
"True, but this citizen is one of the Crow Guard, a juvenile female. I don't think she's much interested in surrendering anything that has caught her fancy."
"Ah,
Paige flipped the lid off the box and barely avoided dunking a corner of the lid into Grimshaw's coffee. As she rummaged, Grimshaw saw a couple of cuff bracelets that might shine with some polish, an engraved lighter, and a few gewgaws he would have to inspect.